Elections in Germany this week. You know, people keep telling us they're doing this and they're doing that in Europe. We should do it. But Europe is a continent without a rudder. I'm John Lefter. The program is Steel on Steel.
Steel on Steel. News, commentary, interview, and debate. An alternative information source for politics, religion, and global events. Now, here's the host of Steel on Steel, John Loeffler.
End of the era of Angela Merkel. It marks a rather important change in Germany, but even at this stage, they can't seem to figure out which direction they're going. And as a continent, that seems to be the whole direction of Europe. Europe is actually a continent coming into severe crisis, but it doesn't seem to know which way to go. So the question is then, when people say, well, the Europeans have been doing this, or Sweden has been doing this, my question is always, and why should we do that? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Steel on Steel. We're a weekly program dedicated to the sharpening of ideas, news, commentary, interview, information, and debate, much of which you will not hear elsewhere. And our goal and pledge for the last almost 31 years now that we've been doing this radio program has been to be an early warning service. We connect seemingly unrelated dots in the area of economics, politics, and religion, project seemingly unrelated trends, and show you how in these three spheres, which all interact, they're coming together just over the horizon where normally the herd doesn't see it. That's because the herd's always listening to their establishment media, who nowadays in the US, Canada, Europe, are not really reporters of news. They are purveyors of narratives. And they do this by reporting some stories, not reporting others, reporting some facts, not reporting others. And 31 years ago, we went on the air to be an antidote to that and an early warning service. So please do remember that your failure to be informed as to what's actually going on does not make me a wacko. One of the things that I saw in a German language newspaper was talking about the tenure of Angela Merkel. She's been there for a long time, and now this is changing, and they can't seem to quite figure out which way they want to go. But one of the things that she was credited with doing was steering the country away from the scourge of populism. And I always have to raise my eyes about this, because you have to ask what populism is. And typically, in the minds of globalists, those people who believe we should move into this global socialist governance, they create this boogeyman out of populism as if it's a bad, evil thing, and then they ascribe all sorts of things to it. What is populism? Well, it's very easy. Populism, the people. We talk a lot in free republics about vox populi, the voice of the people. But if you've noticed lately, the voice of the people is not wanted in this conversation. You are a necessary inconvenience for all of these utopians that we seem to have running our various governments. And when populism comes along, it's a group of people, usually a large group of people, discovering that, wait a minute, with this global socialism, hey, this isn't really a very good thing for us. We're getting the short end of the stick here, as all the wealth and the jobs and everything else is being transferred in the name of a great utopia that is supposed to benefit interdependence around the world. Blah, 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 blah. And of course, when people recognize, as in so many places now, that this dream is wreaking havoc around the globe, they begin to react against it. And that's why the governments have to demonize it, even as the policies of the socialists has just drugged them further and further into disaster. And Europe right now is facing a real energy crisis of its own making, thanks to its nonsensical carbon zero anti-global warming policies that it has walked into eyes wide open. And as somebody who comes from a different continent, much as I love Europe and European culture and Europeans, I have to scratch my head and think, what are they thinking? And maybe that's the question. Reuben Johnson joins us, our correspondent from Kiev, who watches that part of the world for us. And he writes for various military publications on military and geopolitical things. And Reuben, the elections in Germany, looks like the Merkel era is over. I want to tie this together with the looming energy crisis that Europe has built itself into. I mean, walked into this eyes wide open with some of us saying, don't you see where this is going? Apparently not. How does Europe manage to constantly do that will be one of the subjects of conversation. So let's start with the end of the Merkel era.
Well, The Economist has run a story now that says, you know, Merkel has left a mess And it's a combination. I agree with most of what they've said. It's a combination of the fact that the government has not invested enough in new digital technology to run the government in many ways. The country has decided from an international standpoint that they're going to be more interested in business with Russia and China. So the Nord Stream 2 pipeline comes ashore in Germany. Where? It comes ashore in Angela Merkel's home district. And so this makes Germany a big energy power. And as we've talked about before, it gives Russia the ability to strangle Poland and Ukraine to deprive them of gas whenever it's convenient. And Russia has engaged in a program now for several months where they essentially are bending the hose, and they've refused to sell gas in the quantities that they've had in the past, so that Europe, Ukraine, and other countries will have a lower level of reserves for the winter. That's what these countries do. They buy their gas in the summertime because they don't know what Putin's going to do, so they have enough to get them through the winter. Well, they're not going to have enough. So this game has been going on. Meanwhile, the Germans have been ignoring the threat from China. So now you have this election which has come, and the result is that Merkel's party has lost by a narrow margin to the Social Democrats. The Social Democrats will be forced to form a coalition with the Greens and the Free Democrats, the two parties who are very anti-China and anti-Russia. But these three parties agree really on very, very, very little. So we're looking at a paralyzed German government. You're not going to see any great initiatives out of Germany. And Germany, which is supposed to be the leader of the EU, that means a leaderless EU in a situation where, you know about those terms, oxymorons, okay? So jumbo shrimp and airline food and European unity. So I think it's a horrible situation, but Merkel has brought this on by herself. She was in power for 16 years, and she could have really led Germany to become a principled nation that believed in certain values. And it became a country which was only interested in doing business. What Germany has done recently with regard to ignoring what communist China is doing around the world and what the Chinese are doing inside of Germany, they have decided that, you know, don't want to know. This is a real disaster. The Huawei headquarters in Germany operates like a Chinese intelligence unit operating on German territory. That's how bad it is. And no one does anything. There was a report issued in 2018 by the German Internal Security Services, and it talked about how dangerous the level of Chinese influence was in Germany. It was distributed to a handful of high-level German officials. Its existence was only revealed in 2020, 2 years later. But it was revealed that the report, which was supposed to be distributed throughout the German government, was deep-sixed. And no one is saying anything about who was the high-level official who had the report deep-sixed. But everyone thinks that it's Merkel. So this is a travesty within Europe. I really don't know what the European Union is supposed to do. You know, the Brits have left. You've got other countries who want to leave. Many of the countries who are in the EU, and they're part of the EU, they have refused to join the Eurozone. And when they've been asked to join the Eurozone, they've said no. So what is the European Union all about now? What are their basic values? And it's a European Union without the UK. And it's a European Union in which Merkel in Germany has successfully split the continent north and south and east and west.
Let me ask a question as we go through this. I'm watching this looming energy crisis, which threatens a food crisis. Now, we're not talking about, you know, 10 or 20 years like global warming or something. We're talking about this winter. How does Europe manage to constantly back itself into these corners, eyes wide open? Even as it's trying to hit its carbon emissions target, it destroys its nuclear generating industry, therefore making itself incredibly dependent upon Nord Stream pipeline and gas from Russia. Now it's going to have to back into coal to try to keep energy shortages and keep everybody warm. And you ask the very common question, who didn't see this coming? I guess I don't understand it from any kind of a logical sense. Of course, it's the same thing here, whereby we say Nord Stream is okay, but the Keystone Pipeline is not.
Not Nord Stream, the department store, which I really love, but Nord Stream.
Yeah, right, Nord Stream, right.
The UK is an interesting situation. They decided a number of years ago we're not going to have nuclear power plants. So they got the energy companies locked into a situation where they could only pass so much of the cost of energy onto the consumer. So they've now had these energy companies basically going bankrupt. And I've got friends in the UK telling me now, you can drive all over the area and you go to petrol stations and there's no petrol. And not only are ordinary people not able to buy petrol, but police departments are not able to buy petrol. And you have ambulance drivers saying, we don't have petrol to be able to go and collect people who are in need of emergency services. This has another side effect in that one of the byproducts of energy companies is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is what is used to euthanize chickens and other animals that you're turning into food. So you can't do that. So now there's a meat shortage. And this stuff just goes on and on. It's a daisy chain effect.
It's also used in making fertilizer in addition to nitrogen. Like you say, it's a daisy chain and it keeps on going. So this isn't just threatening staying warm. This is the food supply. And we have the COP26 coming up here where they're all supposed to get together and reaffirm their, you know, their climate targets, even as the whole thing is forming a disaster right underneath them.
And as Larry Kudlow said, the Biden policies in America are going to create very expensive energy. There's not going to be enough of it. There are going to be shortages. Add that into an economy which already has all kinds of supply chain issues. I mean, I sit back and I look at this and I say, well, if you were going to demolish the world economy on purpose, could you have done a better job? I don't know. But these are all things that we saw coming. There were lots of people who said, you know, you don't want to do this. If you go down this road, this is what will happen. When you present people in the present age now with facts, with data, if you try to be empirical, well, you're a loser. Well, you don't understand. There's a greater truth. You're just not seeing it. You're right. I'm not seeing it.
Or we have to do this cost up front, but it'll be better on the backside, that type of thing. Because that was the promise that the Marxists always made. You know, it was a three-stage takeover. And they never got past stage two, which was the stage you're going to be miserable and we're going to be totalitarian before we break into that beautiful utopia.
I've spent an enormous amount of my time in the former Soviet Union, which is why I speak Russian without much of an accent. And I know all the bad words and all the jokes, all the songs. But I remember as a young student going through the oldest of the metro stations in Moscow, the ones that were part of the initial construction when they first built the metro. Now, the system is expanded and expanded. You get to the outer stations and they're very austere. But if you go through the original old stations that were built, and the two people who were responsible for building the metro, one was Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev, he was the main, and the other was Lazar Kaganovich. But they built the metro, and these old stations, these initial stations are ornate, and there are these huge chandeliers, beautiful mosaics. And Russians would tell you that, well, the reason they built these stations like this is they were meant to look like palaces. They did this on purpose because this was to show people that this is how we would all live under communism. We'd all live in a palace. And there's a current version of that going on today. You know, we're all going to drive electric cars and we're all going to be sitting at home with our Wi-Fi and we'll have our three big screens with our super fast computers and our fiber optic connection. And we're going to be able to do all of our business sitting. We're not going to have to go to an office. We're not going to have to drive anywhere. And you're like, well, wait a minute. When you go to a store to buy something, in the words of Jimmy Hoffa, you know, if you bought it, it came on a truck. But there's no truck drivers because people aren't going back to work and there's no petrol available and so on. I can't even describe it, but it is a mentality now within the progressive left in America that is creating an even greater level of disparities. This is not sustainable. And we're already seeing shortages in America in ways that are just, they keep popping up. 18 months after COVID, you're still seeing shortages. Now, people aren't standing in line like in the Soviet Union, which I used to see where you'd have a huge line of people trying to buy toilet paper. I had one professor of mine who told me that he lived in the Soviet Union way back, you know, when I was a young child in the 60s. He used to say that if you saw a big line of people, you didn't care what it was. You'd go stand in line. You didn't care because there'd be something at the end of it that you really needed. Or if you didn't need it, you could buy it and you could trade with somebody else. We're not to that point yet. The shortages in America are becoming absolutely tragic. And this is a modern industrialized country. You know, we're assuming all of the aspects of a third world country in law enforcement and the fact that we don't have, you know, law enforcement, particularly federal law enforcement, they do whatever they want and they're never held accountable. The fact that we've got this open border, the fact that we don't have control over voting. I mean, I could go on and on and on forever. But this is the worst situation I've seen in America in my life. This makes Jimmy Carter's America, with the runaway inflation and the runaway interest rate, this makes Jimmy Carter's America look like a paradise.
Does the average person in Europe actually come to grips with what's causing their problem? This is what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, they do. But the difficulty is they can't come to a consensus about what to do about it. I mean, you see this in Germany with the election. You've got a very polarized electorate. And the problem in Germany is that people have a complete inability to think strategically or to think about the government as an entity that is in control of national policy. A lot of people in Germany, when they think about what the government is supposed to do, they say, well, the government is supposed to pick up the rubbish once a week, and there's supposed to be a bike path. But there's a real lack of any consensus about national policy. It comes from the war. Nobody wants another nationalist German government. And then you go to places like the UK, and what do people say? They say, well, we have the Conservative Party under Boris Johnson, and they have all kinds of problems and all kinds of shortcomings, and we don't know really where this is headed. But how could you ever vote for a Labour government? Labour is just, out to lunch. Labour, at least for now, seems to have divested itself of all the anti-Semitism that there was under Jeremy Corbyn. But still, it's not the party of the working class anymore. It's worse than the Democratic Party in America. And so people in Europe, they look at the situation and they're talking about the lesser of two evils, not which party has a better vision.
You know, you saw a lot of that in some of the German language coverage of the election, saying, Merkel, they managed to head off the scourge of populism, and it's just a revamp of the same drivel we're hearing here about nationalism being a terrible thing. And of course, when they talk about populism, they mean the voice of the people. So there's sort of an elitist type of thing there, that we need to be the ones who are in control because we know blah, blah, blah. Heaven forbid the unwashed masses should come to grips with the fact that something's really wrong and want to do something about it. But as I said, watching Europe for me is always a head scratcher.
Well, I've heard this for years in Germany, populism. And I've heard people say it would be bad if we had a snap election right now. If the government fell, it would be bad. Well, why is that? Because we'd end up with some parties that would have seats in the parliament that we really don't want them in the parliament. Now, they're talking about the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland. But they say this would be really terrible. I'm like, okay, well, wait a minute. That's democracy. People vote for what they want. If people are voting for something that you see as a radical agenda, well, there's a reason for that, okay? And how did this come about? Merkel said, we're going to let migrants come in migrants. So the first year that Germany agreed to take migrants, Merkel said, we're going to take 500,000. And I believe these figures are right. They took actually 1.1 million, so more than double, of these Islamic migrants came in. Now, in that same year, there were only 700,000 babies born in all of Germany. And those were not all Germans. There were Ukrainians and Russians and Turks and Poles and so on. And then you look at the demographics of the German population, and you have something like 77.0% of female German scientists who are childless. Now, this is an unsustainable type of a trend. You're going to bury your country in people who don't produce anything, but they take a lot from the state. And no one wants to talk about this. You walk down the streets in some parts of Germany and you hear people muttering, saying, I had these colleagues of mine in one German city. We used to pass by this Turkish place on the way to their office. And the guys would say, they'd look at the Turks and they'd say, are these guys ever sober? And that's a very unfortunate and not a fair assessment of the entire population. But the point was that they're assuming a larger and larger percentage of the population, which doesn't do anything. This is what people were rebelling against. And this is why you're going to end up with a very, very divided parliament. The great fear of many Germans is what you ended up with in the Weimar Republic, is what we call, if you're a political scientist, we call it negative majorities, that you can get a majority of the parliament to vote against anything the government wants to do, but you can't get them to vote for anything.
Okay, I wanted to switch because obviously they've got some energy issues, but there are more important things and we do need to cover it. So let's go to China.
Look, I'm going to say this as gently as I can, which is not very. But in 2018, the chief financial officer of the company Huawei, which is the huge Chinese telecom company, she was taken into custody in Canada, where she lived. Her name is Ming Wenzhou. She was taken into custody by the Canadian authorities at the request of the U.S. And the charge was she had made presentations to a bank from the UK about another company that Huawei was working with. And she was saying they're all completely clean. And it turns out the company was involved in business with Iran. So this would have been a violation of the sanctions that the U.S. has against Iran. And it was one in a long series of situations in which the Chinese have been playing this game of funneling money to Iran while claiming that they're not. So she was taken into custody and extradition hearings were started against her. This is in 2018. That's 3 years ago, almost, December of 2018. So she's in Canada. And she is going through a series of legal maneuvers to keep her from being extradited, one appeal after another after another. Well, within a few days of her being taken into custody, the Chinese grabbed two Canadians, one who was a former diplomat, one was a businessman, on manufactured charges, and they throw these guys into prison. Now, Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of Huawei, the queen of Huawei, as my friends in China call her, she's moving back and forth between two elaborate mansions in Vancouver on the west coast of Canada. She's out on bail. She has to wear an ankle bracelet, but she's shopping in luxury boutiques, and she's eating in fancy restaurants, and she has a phalanx of security guards, which are paid for by her company. And the security guards are, in theory, they're supposed to keep her from running away and fleeing the country. But what they're really doing is protecting her from having to answer questions from the press or anything else. Meanwhile, the two Canadian men are being held in cells in which the floor, ceiling, walls are all white, bright white, and the light is never turned off. The light is on 24 hours a day. Psychological torture. And they lived under these conditions for more than 1,000 days. So this past week, the United States decides, under Biden, they decide to make a deal. And she's allowed to fly home to China. She's not going to be extradited to the U.S. The charges against her are deferred. And the two men, Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig, are immediately flown home to Canada. Now, I'm not going to use my words. I'm going to read to you from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. Westerners working in China are officially on notice. You could be arrested on trumped up charges at any time and used as hostages to promote Communist Party interests. That's the message from the humiliating U.S. surrender to China's hostage diplomacy in the case of Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou. This article goes on, but I'm here to tell you, parents out there, if your son and daughters want to go to China for some kind of academic study, don't send them. Unless they're going to study Babylonian basket weaving or something like that. Anyone doing any kind of business, doing any kind of scholarly work, doing anything now can be seized. And these two Canadian gentlemen, they never had an open, fair trial. The proceedings were closed to the public. We don't even know what the charges were. That the Chinese justice system is, that's a contradiction in terms. This is the Biden administration basically caving in to blackmail. It's right up there with, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists, but we did with the Taliban. But, you know, now we're negotiating with hostage takers. So now this gets worse. The South China Morning Post, which is the Hong Kong English language Chinese paper, is running a big, long article about the conversations between Wang Qishan, who's the vice president of China, but the man who's one of the most powerful men on the Chinese Politburo Standing Committee, his interactions with an executive from Goldman Sachs. And Wang Qishan, he was the person that has dealt with some of the highest treasury and economic officials in America over the years. And he delivers this defense of the Chinese Communist Party, saying that, well, you know, the Chinese people chose the Communist Party. And the efforts by the Trump administration to delegitimize the party is trying to drive a wedge between the party and the people. The South China Morning Post is a Hong Kong paper. It's an English language paper. And for the longest time, it was the voice of independence from the mainland. And this article is a travesty because, first of all, it's a slavish propaganda screed by the Communist Party. Secondly, the Chinese people did not choose the Communist Party. The people who rebelled against the Kuomintang government in 1949 were Chinese nationalists. They were tired of seeing China being carved up and subjugated by foreign powers. Had nothing to do with choosing the Communist Party. And as time goes on, the Communist Party has less and less and less appeal. So this article is a complete sham. And at the same time, the article mentions that this is the 50th anniversary of this wonderful event in the history of mankind, which was the historic visit of Henry Kissinger to Beijing to normalize relations between the People's Republic of China and the United States. That was a different China. It was a different time. That was a China that really wanted to be a partner with America. This China does not want to be a partner with America. This China is against everything that America stands for. And we see this over and over and over. And on top of all this, they have created this pandemic, which has destroyed our world. And yet you have one of the most prestigious newspapers in the country now talking about how Americans, particularly Donald Trump, that America is evil because we are questioning the Communist Party's legitimacy. I'm sorry, but this is really in that category of gag me with the ladle, because gag me with the spoon is not enough.
But what would have happened had they extradited the woman to the United States? What would have happened to the two Canadian citizens who obviously hadn't done anything wrong? This was one of those Soviet-style trump-up charge things.
Well, the Canadian citizens would have stayed there, and they would have grabbed a couple of Americans. And so quite a long time ago, one of my intelligence community friends said to me, he says, this is what the Chinese are doing. They're doubling down. If you arrest one of theirs, they arrest two of yours. If you delay one of their guys' visas for 2 months, they delay your guys for 4 months, and so on. If you remember that famous scene from the 1987 or 88 film, I can't remember, The Untouchables, with Kevin Costner and Sean Connery.
Yeah.
And they're in the Catholic Church, and Sean Connery says, you want to know how you get Capone? He says, if he brings a knife, you bring a gun. If he sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the only language these people understand. And unfortunately, we have a lot of people who don't want to know.
Let us move on. Russians held their once every 4 years joint exercise with Belarus. They call it a defense exercise, but it really seems to be more than that politically.
Yeah, it's called Zapad. Zapad is a word in Russian that means West. Yeah, they ran the exercise for a period of about 7 days. And first of all, Zapad is part of a 4-year-long training cycle where you do a lot of things to prepare for it. And then there's about a 3-month buildup. But the only part we see is the stuff they show on the television, you know, where they do the live fire and there's a lot of explosions and Vladimir Putin is looking through his binoculars. What it comes down to is this is creating the conditions for an even closer integration of Russian and Belarusian armed forces. And we don't know what's going to happen in Belarus because Alexander Lukashenko, the president there, has been under siege now ever since August of last year when he was quote unquote reelected in an openly fraudulent election. And there's been an open public revolt ever since. And there continues to be speculation that at some point he'll flee the country and Russia will just move in, Anschluss type, and take over all of Belarus. So there's always a speculation that part of the exercise is preparation for that. But what's really concerning to a lot of people is that, number one, the Belarusians have ordered and they have taken delivery of some, the rest of the stuff is coming. But they've purchased more than $1 billion of Russian weaponry, which includes brand new fighter aircraft and the latest air defense systems, the most advanced Russian air defense system, some of which are going to be only 4 kilometers from the Polish border. And these systems are not about the Belarusian military independently being able to defend itself, but it's all about integrating the Belarusian military's air defense and air force with the Russian air force. So the two countries are going to be prepared, if necessary, to launch an attack into Poland and the Baltics. And if the Russians move into Belarus in force, then Ukraine, where I am now, we are surrounded on 3 sides by Russian forces. So that's one point. The second part of the exercise, which is, I think, even more alarming, is the fact that you got a lot of Russian units who've had experience in Syria and the Donbass, eastern Ukraine. And so the Russians are really perfecting the logistics that they use in wartime. And every senior military commander from Napoleon to Omar Bradley, famous World War II general, has been credited with the phrase that amateurs discuss tactics and professional soldiers study logistics. And these exercises are a lot about logistics. They're a lot about training your people so that if you have to move out and attack the West, this is not a defensive exercise. This is an exercise preparing to attack the West. That if you have to move out and attack the West, you're prepared to support that. And you know what's required to provide supply and spare parts and all the support that you need so that you can keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. And you don't have to stop and regroup. And part of that equation is after this exercise, we're seeing the Russians leaving behind a record amount of spare parts, ammunition, fuel, heavy equipment. So they're basically one snap deployment away from being ready to launch an attack on NATO. This is all being done. And President Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus made it clear that it's not just an attack on NATO. It would be an attack on Ukraine because he came out of a very, very long, several hours set of meetings with Putin. And he said, well, you know, we got to be prepared for these exercises because, you know, we have this big, long border with Ukraine. What he's saying is this is being prepared to invade and attack Ukraine as well as attacking NATO. So this is a very dangerous set of people with some very dangerous ideas preparing for a major offensive into Western Europe at a time when you have an American president who is non compos mentis.
And it would seem like they would wait for an appropriate opportunity. As a matter of fact, if more things happened at once, the better. In other words, China on Taiwan, Russia with Belarus, and or who knows what's happening with Western Europe. What do the Poles think about all this? Have you been in contact with any of that?
Yes, the Poles are very worried, including the Polish prime minister. I didn't talk to him personally, but he said that, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities for provocations here. And Poland declared an emergency situation during this exercise. They didn't know what was going to happen. And you can't blame them because they're right there on the front line and they have a less than happy history with the Russians. I don't think anyone has read their history about this part of the world.
Listen, we haven't read the history about our part of the world now.
But I'm saying this to you. We're in the most dangerous situation I've seen. I think this is as dangerous as it's been since maybe 1968 when the Russians, when the Soviets came in and they took Czechoslovakia. But I think it's worse than that because that was the Soviet Union and we were the United States. And there were mechanisms for the two countries to communicate with each other that don't exist now. The greatest possibilities now are for miscalculation. I don't see anyone on the Russian side that has a realistic view of America. And what makes it worse is you have a chairman of the Joint Chiefs who goes before the Congress and says that our biggest problem is white supremacy within the ranks of our armed services. This is theater of the absurd. And you'll notice that you've had this debacle in Afghanistan that we've talked about. This is a complete disaster. And we've had an airstrike of these over-the-horizon capabilities that were supposed to be so great, but turns out they're not. We've had an airstrike. We've killed 10 innocent people, including 7 children. And General Milley came out and told us it was a righteous strike. And now we find out it wasn't. Have you seen anyone ready to resign? Because I haven't. Nobody resigns. No one at upper levels is ever punished. A private who loses his weapon is in for 100 times greater punishment than a general who calls for an airstrike that kills 10 innocent people.
All right. Anything else we need to cover? Let me just ask you that.
You have to be in China. You have to be working in China the way you have to be and be harassed by the security services to understand what this is all about. You know, Chinese journalists come over here and they do what they want. If they do something really egregious, they can be kicked out of the country. But that's rare. Americans working in China who are doing anything, you're under 24-hour-a-day surveillance. You're under all kinds of harassment you cannot imagine. The joke in China now, among Chinese people, not among foreigners, among the Chinese population, is they say, you know, we look at North Korea, and we used to say that's what the past in China was like, you know, cultural revolution. But we look at North Korea today, and we realize that's our future. It's not our past anymore. That's our future. Those are ordinary Chinese people saying that. This is not me. It's not foreigners. Now, I don't know what kind of a situation that's going to produce between our two countries, but something tells me it's not going to be a very happy one.
It looks like one of these situations that builds and then something will trip. You know how that works in military politics. Then the dominoes, which have been set in place, suddenly go just like that.
Look, in the 1930s, one of the rationales for appeasement of Germany was that the French army was huge. They had the largest army in all of Europe. And the rationale was that, well, you know, if the Nazis get out of control and they really start to go off and become really dangerous, the French will move in and stomp on them. So that's our insurance policy. We don't have to do anything. We're fine. And that's what Hitler's generals were telling him. Like, you can't do this. The French will come in and stomp on us. So then you have the Munich Pact, where they meet, and the Western powers, with Mussolini as an interpreter and interlocutor, basically give away the Sudetenland, and the Czechs aren't even at the table. And Hitler goes back to Germany, and his generals say, well, you can't take the rest of Czechoslovakia. The French will come in, and British will come in. And he said, no, they won't. He said, I saw these people at Munich. They're worms. They're not going to do anything. I can do whatever I want. That was his calculation. I'm pretty sure there's a similar type of calculation going on inside the upper Chinese leadership now. You think about what's happened under Obama. The Russians occupied Crimea. They invaded the Donbass. The Chinese built these islands in the South China Sea on top of reefs. They're constantly harassing Taiwan. They're constantly threatening other countries in the region. They're engaged in all-out economic war, all-out espionage, cyber warfare, stealing as much American technology as they can. The only country that's really stepped up and said, we realize that this is an aggressive, belligerent, expansionist China has been the Australians, which is why they signed off on this recent agreement with the US and the UK, and where the Australians will become the seventh country in the world to have nuclear-powered submarines supplied by the US and the UK. But the Chinese have to be looking at our, and not just under Biden, but under his former boss, Obama, they have to be looking at what's going on and saying, well, you know, we can do whatever we want. So I'm deeply concerned now about where all this is going. I'm not sure we have a military that's going to be prepared to deal with it, because aside from not having enough ships and enough planes and enough people to man them, we've now got a senior leadership that thinks that being woke is more important than being prepared.
Very much so, Reuben. I wanted to thank you for your time. Reuben Johnson, our correspondent from Kiev in Ukraine, and he watches both Europe and China and Russia. That's not both, I guess. It's all of those things from his vantage point. You have to ask yourself, and I think I asked one of our participants, our guests here, last couple episodes, you know, they all go by as a blur after a while, and I have lose track of where I did this. Is this all by intent or default? And when you look at everything that's actually going wrong and what we're doing right now, government-wise, we're squabbling over all sorts of really dumb stuff, fighting over the levers of power, but at the same time doing everything that's bad for the country. Remember, nationalism is bad. And we have to think of the globalist community, which of course means you're about to take it in the short, so to speak. And the same thing is happening in Europe. Don't they see what they're doing with this energy? Even as we talk about going to the COP26 conference this month, another global warming summit where we pledge to reduce our carbon emissions. I want to look at this one in a future program coming up of what's happening in Great Britain, exactly what this is doing. And that was that fourth question that we've asked all along. And that is, okay, let's assume that global warming's terrible. What are you going to do about it? And the only answer they have is kill the economy, because they have to do it with taxes, making energy more expensive. When energy is more expensive, inflation just soars. Everything becomes expensive. Things slow down. Standard of living goes down. And people even die as a result of that, which ostensibly is the goal for trying to prevent global warming anyway, to keep people from dying. So this is the kind of crazy rhetoric we're hearing, where the reality and the rhetoric are dividing further and further apart. But you notice that as this tug of war goes on, it's reality which is becoming real. We're building in increments towards further snaps where something will happen. And this is way over and above all of the controversy going on about vaccinations right now and mandates. And you even look at the stupid stuff that's going on in terms of that, where companies are letting go of good people, really good people, important people, long-term people in their companies over this mandate. And hospitals are firing staff and then complaining that their staff are overworked. And it goes deeper than that, beginning to have some of our people talk to people in various medical centers. And the official stories and what's actually going on are two different things. I'm trying to see if we can put together some kind of show on that. So this is where we are. It's a day when truth is hard to come by. And you have to figure your way through this and where we're going. As I've said before, if this isn't the end times, as it's described in both the Old and the New Testaments, it's a great dress rehearsal, because you can go down the checklist now where previous groups of Christians could not. They were trying to make things work. Now you don't have to try. It's all just falling into place. We are in a major paradigm shift worldwide, but especially in the West, as it tries to commit suicide. And a handful of people, or a growing number of people, are trying to prevent it from doing so. So it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. On behalf of Steve Schiller, producer, I'm John Loeffler. We're at steelonsteel.com. The program is Steel on Steel. Well, the first time I heard about the Black Robed Regiment, I thought, wow, this sounds like an army of Jesuits. Because if you remember when the Jesuits were busy missionizing, especially around the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes early on in the founding of the colonies, both in the U.S. and Canada, so to speak, they were called Black Robes. But I discovered, well, no, it wasn't that. But it does have relevance to today. Dan Fisher has a routine in which he presents bringing back the Black Robed Regiment and how it is relevant to today. And I'm going to start out, Dan, by firing a negative salvo, not at you, by the way.
Sure.
But my favorite expression is, in these worldview battles we've been having here, losing thousands of our children to the secular, socialist, atheist education they're receiving in public schools. For three decades, we've been telling pastors, get your kids out, get your kids out, get your kids out. And when danger reared its ugly head, the pastors turned and bravely fled. In the name of Jesus, they bravely ran away. But obviously, you're trying to challenge that today. Talk about Black Robes.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, you know, back in 2006 or 7, I heard about the Black Robed Regiment, and I thought they were lawyers or judges. It's the only people I could think of that wore black robes. Turns out it was the preachers of the 18th century, And they carry that title because it was given to them by the British. These men believe that the Bible addresses every area of life and that Christians ought to be engaged in every arena. So they saw no difference in being involved spiritually in church or being involved in spiritually in government. They believe you do everything as unto the Lord. And so these guys preached principles of justice and proper government and railed against injustice and tyranny from their pulpits. And when the War of Independence broke out, some of these guys were actually in the Continental Congress and voted to declare independence. And then, as I say, when the war broke out, many of these men led the members of their churches, their communities, off to fight. And they actually went onto the battlefields and fought the enemy. And others fought in the halls of the Continental Congress. So these guys were the tip of the spear in protecting liberty. And they were really the primary reason why the Republic was birthed. And today we have a far cry from that. As you just said, pastors hear the battle cry and they find out which direction the firing's coming from and they turn and go the other way. And it is time for pastors to regain the same courage, boldness as their predecessors in the 18th century. If we don't, I am convinced that just as they helped to birth the Republic, modern preachers are going to help to bury the Republic. So that's what I go around doing. I'm an active pastor myself. I've served in the legislature in Oklahoma while serving as pastor of a church of over 1,000 people. So I have a little bit of experience in this, and I walk the talk. I don't just talk the talk. So that's a little bit of a preview.
Let me ask you a question now, because I watched the presentation you did here.
Yes.
And it was, you know, it was inspiring. I keep wondering why the idea of spiritual warfare, which has its manifestations in the physical here, has been so lost on the church. That if you look at all of the words that, say, for example, the Apostle Paul uses in the scripture, they're all aggressive words.
Yeah.
They are run, contend, stand, fight, you know,
yeah.
All these things.
Soldier, warfare. Yeah.
Right, soldier, warfare, defend, yeah. Armor. Everything is, even resistance, is aggressive, not passive.
Exactly.
Where did we ever lose this? And you're right, I'm thinking like you presented, Patrick Henry. Flaming
yeah.
speeches telling people this is what's right. Where did we go off the rails?
Yeah, well, or I'm thinking of a speech that was given by John Witherspoon, who was a Presbyterian preacher and the president of what became Princeton. He was a member of the Continental Congress, and he gives an impassioned speech when the delegates were getting a little bit weak in the knees about declaring independence, and his speeches was one of the moments that pushed the guys over the line. I'll tell you, I think what happened is the very same thing that Paul addresses in the epistles to the early church, though he doesn't use the word Gnosticism, it is Greek Gnosticism in a modern form. You know, the Gnostics believed that everything that was material was unredeemable and unimportant, not eternal, so they just focused on the spirit. So they kind of had a dichotomy. They practiced what I would call compartmentalization. So they would talk about, you know, do whatever you want to do in the body because that's perishable. It doesn't matter. Just, you know, spiritually, you need to seek the higher levels in thought. And today, we kind of have the same thing operating. It's as if Christians believe that the only fight that is spiritual is that which they can talk about philosophically. They don't believe that there's ever a time to actually stand up and speak out and confront evil. So they kind of compartmentalize their lives into the secular and the sacred, and they don't mix the two. And of course, that's where the whole concept of separation of church and state comes from. All of this comes from that same root problem of compartmentalization.
Which is a hallmark of postmodern thinking, by the way, because
exactly
postmodern,
right.
Postmodern thinking is self-contradictory in its
yep.
nature, and the only way to keep the contradictions, although we're seeing it in the political process, I mean, they're clanging and banging into each other all the time, because of this, is that the only way is to compartmentalize it.
Yeah.
But what I'm discovering is pastors, young pastors coming into the church and youth group leaders and everything, they've been indoctrinated with this. So how can you
yes.
lead somebody if you yourself are believing the philosophy of the enemy?
That's exactly right. They're mostly all woke now, and they're social justice warriors, when they don't realize that there's no such thing as social justice. There's either justice or injustice. So these guys, they have, number one, I guess they have not been taught their heritage, probably at any level. They have no idea about the American experience, really. They don't understand the difference in a republic and a democracy. So you'll hear those words used interchangeably. And even though a republic uses the democratic process, it's far from a democracy. A democracy was the very thing the framers were seeking to avoid. There's nothing more brutal than just slightly over 50% having the authority to steamroll just slightly under 50%. But you see us working today in our culture and in our government, and that's the way it's working. America's kind of split down the middle. So you basically see this. So they don't understand what a republic is, which is, of course, government of the people, by the people, for the people, by the rule of law. They don't understand that. They don't understand that government operates by the consent of the governed. They'll read the passage where Jesus says, render to Caesar, and they think Caesar is Washington, D.C., or the state capital. But in a republic, Caesar is the people, and the government works for the people. They just don't understand these things. They haven't been taught these things. They've never heard of the Black Robe Regiment. They don't know the price that the preachers and their congregants paid to earn and secure this liberty that they take so for granted. So they don't know any of these things. And I believe that it is a leftist strategy that has been employed over the decades to actually teach these out of our colleges and our seminaries. So we don't teach any of these things. People just don't know. They don't even know civics.
So now the solution to that, because very much like Peter on the morning of the resurrection, they're arriving late, out of breath, wondering what's happening. The solution to that, I personally maintain, it's in taking a hard grip within churches of the education of the youth, but that's going to take time. So what else?
Well, I think what we have to do is we have to try to motivate the pastors. Obviously, the pastor is the spiritual leader. He's not necessarily the spiritual know-it-all, but he is the spiritual leader. God designed it that way. Typically, people will follow their leaders, and they want to know what their pastor believes and what Scripture says about all of these areas. Even people sitting in churches with a woke pastor, they're really dying to hear, what does the Bible truly say about theft through taxation? What does the Bible have to say about securing borders? Is that a biblical Christian position? Is it not? You know, what does the Bible say about abortion? Is that just a woman's right to choose, or is that murder? They want to know, and they really value their pastor's opinions, assuming that he's drilled into Scripture and knows himself. So what we've got to do is we've got to find what I call the low-hanging fruit. And what I mean by that is there are pastors scattered out all over Idaho, all over Montana, all over Oklahoma, where I'm from, all across the Union, who are ready, they just don't know. They either don't know these facts, or they don't know how to speak about them or how to address them from the pulpit, but they're willing. All they have to be is just instructed and taught a little bit. So for us, in all of our efforts, what we're doing is we're looking for the low-hanging fruit. We're not trying to find the guys that want to stand and argue for 30 or 40 minutes about whether or not a woman has a right to choose. In my opinion, if a pastor believes that abortion is just a personal choice, he has deeper problems than understanding a republic or speaking out. Probably needs to get his heart right with God. So we're looking for the low-hanging fruit. We're trying to educate these pastors and get them to start leading congregations. And a very organized minority can always overcome an unorganized majority. God always specializes in using a remnant. We just have to pull that remnant together.
Well, that's the challenge. Now, you give presentations at churches.
Yes.
How hard do you have? Let's start with this one. How hard do you have getting into churches? Let's do with that one. Okay.
Well, pretty hard. Unfortunately, the larger the church, the less prone they are to be interested. And I believe that's easily understood, because the larger a church is, the more a pastor feels like he has to lose. George Barna, back in 2014, was doing a study on pastors, and he asked pastors, does the Bible address the social ills of our day and things that are considered controversial? And 90% of them said, yes, it does. And then he asked the same ones, okay, are you going to address these things from the pulpit? And about 90% said, no, we're not. So he asked them why. And the top two reasons that these pastors gave for not engaging the culture war is that it would hurt the attendance in their churches, and it would hurt the size of their offerings. So, yes, we do find it hard. As the church gets larger, less apt. But the smaller the church, and when I say smaller, I don't mean necessarily 10 people, but a church of 500 or less, typically they're very open, they're interested, most of the institutions, Christian institutions, forget about the secular, we're not even trying to drill into that. We're just trying to awaken the church. Most of the Christian institutions, they're closed, they're too cool for school, or they're too afraid of controversy, or they just don't want to know because if they ever know, then they're required to do something and they don't want to do anymore.
But you know, and I know too, Dan, that we are at the point where this worldview change, it's a literal paradigm shift in Western culture, will not leave the church alone. So the only question these pastors have is, A, you're going to fight now and take the consequences, or B, not fight then, but still take the consequences because it will come, or C, just apostatize and deny Christ, which I expect to happen.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, if you go back to the framers, and what I call the framers is the generation of James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, those guys. You go back to that period of time, you constantly in their writings hear them talk about civil and religious liberty, and they always link the two together. We tend to just say liberty, and we don't think about them that way, but they always saw liberties as being tandem, civil and religious. And they make the comment over and over and over that if you lose one, you lose the other. So, for instance, if there's not a strong Christian witness, then guys like John Adams said, well, our Constitution won't work because it was written for a moral and religious people. Benjamin Franklin says that the less moral a people become, the more need they have of government to control them. George Washington says the two supports that hold up a republic are morality and religion, and you're not going to have morality if you don't have a strong religious, and he meant Christian, influence. So you've got civil and religious liberty. Those two go together, and somehow our culture has decided that they can allow civil liberty to just go down the river and just sit by and watch as our civil liberties are eroded, but somehow they're going to be safe in their churches. Well, you just hit the nail on the head. They aren't going to be. Back to John Witherspoon, he said there's not an instance in history in which civil liberty was lost and religious liberty was preserved entire. So they're either going to fight now and take the consequences and offend some people, but in the end do what is right, or they're going to wait until it's reached such critical mass, which I'm concerned that we may be at that point now, and they've almost waited too long to fight, like the church in Germany did. Some stood up, but it was too late. Or, like you said, they're just going to roll over, and they'll be woke, and they'll apostatize, and they'll do whatever the government tells them to do.
Okay, how do people get a hold of you? Let's say a church would like to have your presentation or just find out more. The other thing, by the way, we have to do is organize this a bit more, because I'll be honest, the progressive left, I'm not talking about your average liberal, progressive left lives this like a religion. They breathe it morning, noon, and night. It is their raison d'etre, to use the... If you don't know what that means, you're from Oklahoma. If you don't know what that means, I'll tell you later after the show. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry. My mother-in-law's from Oklahoma. I couldn't resist.
Oh, okay.
So give some people info about yourself.
Oh, I'd be happy to. I think the best thing they could do is just go to my website. It's a very simple website. It's my name, Dan Fisher, and then the three letters BRR. They stand for BlackRobeRegiment.com. So it's DanFisherBRR.com. I have written on this subject. I have a book that's available on that website that I spent 2 years writing. It's over 100 sources, the bibliography, well over 600 footnotes. It's not filled with anecdotes. Everything is documented, history of these guys. Their stories are just simply amazing. I wrote it as kind of a textbook so people could read about their lives, have their quotes available. I've also recently released a book on the first five verses of Romans 13, which is kind of the go-to passage that most pastors have used to tell their people, you have to knuckle under, and if you don't, you're sinning. So I've dealt with that. We've done a video that kind of gives you were talking about a while ago, a 30,000-foot view of who the Black Robe Regiment is. It's kind of an on-site, me in uniform documentary. So then go to my website. There's also my calendar there and ways to contact me. That'd probably be the best way.
That's good. And the website, once again, is...
Dan Fisher, BRR.com.
I thought that, well, that's Black Robe Regiment. I thought that was there because it's cold in Oklahoma in the wintertime. Okay.
Well, you know, oddly enough, it can be cold in Oklahoma, but probably not like Idaho.
All right, Dan Fisher, BRR.com. Dan, appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you, sir.
I forgot to mention that Dan was in the Oklahoma State Legislature for several terms. So he has put his money where his mouth is. If you want to see his presentation, go to our church's website, candlelight.org, and go to the section where it says video, or I think it says see or hear or something like that. And he gave the presentation on Wednesday, September 22nd, Dan Fisher, Black Robed Regiment. And you can figure out whether or not you actually want to have him come to your church and do this talk and presentation. So that's numero uno. The other thing is, I got a call from a pastor one day who was complaining to me that he was pretty much alone. None of the other pastors in his area was willing to challenge this. I said, you know, Pastor, you're not alone. You're just separated from each other. And remember, there's unity and strength. That's what fellowship is all about. And every once in a while, we keep talking about getting a chain of information going for pastors like that so that they can come together and at least feel reinforced in the whole thing. You know, as we wrap up the program, please remember that the West is going through a paradigm shift right now. And as it goes through this paradigm shift, which means the rules of everything are changing, for Christians, we have a lot of hope because we understand that everything here is temporary anyway, regardless of how old you are, what your ideas are for life, that God is always there guiding everybody who turns to him for guidance. That's the hope that we have. Many, many people now, you hear from doctors saying that they are being inundated with requests for tranquilizers and antidepressants, things of that nature, because they're just so agitated by what's happening. And our media aren't helping at all, to be honest with you. They are agitating it even worse. And so that's why having good sources of news and information are important. But your best source of information is always God, who can guide you where you need to go. That's why Christians have hope. This is temporary. And we carry out our responsibilities while we're here, but knowing that it is just temporary. All right, pray for us for provision and protection. Pray for those suffering for their faith, especially in Afghanistan right now and countries around there, in Pakistan as well. I'm thinking of North Korea, China, Vietnam, Nigeria. And don't forget to pray for your governments at all different levels at this time. On behalf of producer Steve Schiller and special program producer Carol Loeffler, I'm John Loeffler. We're at steelonsteel.com. Be safe this week. The program is Steel on Steel.